Crimen and Day. All glories to the assembled virtues. All glories to the assembled virtues. All glories to the assembled virtues. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Guru and Mahavishnu. Krishna Krishna. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Taparamam Sri Guru Vaishnavamstha Sri Rupam Sarvajankam Sahagana Vagnatam Rupam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Parijana Sankha Krishna Chaitam Devam Sri Maha Krishna Padam Sahagana Vaita Sri Vishapam Rupam Stam Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
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 It's February 22nd, 2009 in Auckland. We're reading from Canto 6, Chapter 4, Text 15 to 17 about those very subtle laws of reincarnation. First we'll read from One of our big problems is that the so-called counter-cult movement has gotten some support from well-known psychiatrists, etc., that our movement, our religious disciplines, chanting, etc., are all methods of brain control, brainwashing, etc. These scholarly books written by Dr. Jude, etc., help smash this lying propaganda before it's too late. Already these enemies want the U.S. government to try to stop our activities, and they want the courts to give permission to any parent who doesn't like our movement to remove their son or daughter by force. Expressing his confidence that these demons would utterly fail, Rameshwar Maharaj then detailed book distribution plans for the next 2 months, the biggest of the year. Our goal is to distribute at least 400,000 hardbound books in November and December, or almost 6,700 books per day on the average. We have just announced our fourth annual BBT Christmas sale, and if everything goes according to our projection, we will be ordering 1 million hardbound Bhagavad Gita's to be reprinted in early 1977. Okay, so text 17 is on the board. Alam Dadarajumar Dinai Kilanam Shivamastuva Varkshieva Varakanya Patnive Pratigriyatam. So we have Kanya and Patni. So the Kanya is going to become a Patni. What's a Kanya?
Daughter.
A daughter or maiden and a Patni, we say? What? So this is again the predominating deity of the trees, Soma. The moon god is speaking. There is no need to burn these poor trees any longer. Let whatever trees still remain be happy. Indeed, you should also be happy. Remember last time we were talking about not benefiting one at the expense of another. So Soma is saying the trees should be happy, and you should also be. Indeed, you should also be happy. Now, here is a beautiful, well-qualified girl named Madisha, who was raised by the trees as their daughter. You may accept this beautiful girl as your wife. Itya mantra varo rahum kanyam apsarasim nirpa somaraja yaya datva te dharme no paye mire. Sukadeva Goswami continued, my dear king, after thus pacifying the prachetas, Soma, the king of the moon, gave him the beautiful girl born of Pramlocha Apsara. The prachetas all received Pramlocha's daughter who had high, very beautiful hips and married her according to the religious system. These two verses, and of course this is described also in the fourth canto, is an example of two things that are not very common. So what are the two uncommon things happening in this marriage? One of them should be obvious. Several husbands. How many husbands? How many prachetas are there? Ten. Generally, it's hard enough to keep one husband happy. You can keep 10 husbands. Why, by the way, generally, when there's what's nowadays called plural marriage, why usually does the man have more than one wife rather than the woman have more than one husband? Yes? There should be more women population than men. Do you know that right now that has changed? Right now, in many parts of the world, there's more men than women. Do you know why?
No wars.
No wars? Well, there's still some wars, not really big ones, but yeah. Why else? What's happening to the girls? What's happening to the girls? Yeah, the girls are being killed. I just got a message yesterday from one devotee in Maharashtra who can't find a wife. And he said that in my caste, Malwari caste or something, he said there's hardly any girls anymore. I said, yes, because they're killing all the girls. So when you outlaw polygamy, you make it very difficult for people to want to have daughters. Because if naturally there's going to be more women than men, but if polygamy is outlawed, then what's the chances that you're going to get your daughter married? It goes down, right? And just a tiny difference, if there's 51% women and 49% men, that means, like in a country like the UK, you'd have 8 million more marriageable age women than men. The percentage sounds small, but the numbers are very, very big. So especially in traditional cultures where people want to get all their daughters married, now they're killing their daughters. And it's a well-known fact that they're doing selective abortions to kill the girls, sometimes killing them after birth. And by the way, this is happening in countries like New Zealand too. It's not just that it's happening in China and India, where it's, of course, very widespread, but it's happening here too. And now, therefore, the male population is increasing. So I don't know if because the male population is increasing, we're going to start having polyandry. That's why is another reason why we find one man having more than one wife instead of one woman having more than one husband.
Desires?
You could explain that a little bit. That maybe men have more of a desire to enjoy more than one woman than women have a desire to enjoy more than one man. That could be true.
Because he's lazy.
Hmm?
Because he's lazy. He wants the woman to do all the work.
He wants the women to do all the work for him? I think you're getting kind of close to the answer.
Yeah.
Prabhupada says that the man has this psychology of always wanting to be right, even when he's wrong. He has a psychology of wanting to be in charge. So you find that you can have many employees, but it's hard to have many employers. I mean, you can have them in series. You could work one job in the morning and one job in the afternoon. But have you ever been in some sort of situation where you have more than one person telling you what to do? Anybody ever been in that situation? Yeah, I lived in a temple once like that, where we had two GBCs, and each GBC appointed a different person to be in charge of the temple. Now, supposedly, they were supposed to run different parts of the temple. So one was supposed to run the deity worship and like that, and the other one was supposed to run the tours. It was a historic building, and we had tours. But they were in conflict with one another, because the person who ran the tours said he didn't want devotees walking around in devotional clothes and tilak when the tours were going on. And the person running the temple activities wanted to have the festivals in the temple. And also they were in charge often of the same people. So one of them would say, you know, I want Krishna Das to do this at 10 o'clock. And they would say, no, I want Krishna Das to do this at 10 o'clock. So what do you do if both of your authorities, if your authorities have equal weight, and they're telling you to do opposite things? A little problematic, isn't it? So this is one of the big reasons. The other reason is just biology. And as far as the woman getting pregnant, giving birth to children, and so forth. So we find it's very rare that we find polyandry where a woman has more than one husband. In fact, I only know of one other case, and that of Draupadi. Although when Draupadi was married, Srila Vyasadeva gave some other examples in history of women who have more than one husband. So there are some other cases like that. In the case of Draupadi and Madisha, we also find that the husbands were all 10 husbands here are brothers, which is the same with Draupadi. So how does that make things a little simpler?
It's a natural hierarchy.
Yes, it's a natural hierarchy. The eldest brother is in charge. So it's a little bit simpler. If you have contradictory instructions from your different husbands, the younger brother will accept the older brother as the authority, and that makes it a little simpler. And even today, Prabhupada says that in some parts of India, this is still practiced, especially in some of the hilly areas of Kerala. And generally, it's the same thing. A woman will marry several brothers, not just different unrelated men. So that's the first thing here that's unusual. I mean, we might mark that Vedic civilization doesn't necessarily conform to modern ideas of morality. So modern ideas of morality is there has to be monogamy, that any kind of plural marriage is immoral, but that's not the case in Vedic scriptures. Of course, you could say that was from another age, but our Srila Prabhupada came within 1 millimeter of taking a second wife. So, and they were gave various instructions and discounts at different times. So this is something that is part of our moral structure. What's the other thing that's very unusual? I don't know if anybody's going to get this. They were saying, who is this Marisha? She's the child of who? Who are her parents? We're just saying here in text 16, who's her parents? Well, who's her mother anyway? Her father was mentioned earlier. Well, the trees raised her. The trees, or the deity of the trees, were her adoptive parents. But who were her birth parents? Her mother was an apsara, right, which is what's mentioned in text 16. Kanya apsarasi mripa. Apsarasi. She's the maiden born of an apsara from Locha. And her father was Kanva Muni. So, is she a very highly qualified girl? Is she highly qualified or not?
It would seem so.
It would seem so. She's being married on the order of Lord Vishnu. She's marrying the Prachetas, who are all pure devotees. Were her parents married? Was it like a really nice situation, dharmically? Was it? Yes or no? What was the situation? One of those sages who's doing austerities, and Indra says, you know, I'm afraid if he's doing austerities, he's going to become Indra. Let me distract him from his service. It was one of those stories. So we see that although we have a general instruction that good children are born within marriage to people who are performing the samskaras, we find exceptions. There are definitely exceptions. It's not an absolute. And then we also find exceptions the other way. Right? We have someone like King Anga, who not only is properly married, I mean, not only does he perform a samskara, he performs a whole jagya, and the personality comes out of the fire, right, and gives the payasa, and then he has a son named Vena. And a similar thing happened with Sagara. Sagara had two wives, and one had 60,000 sons, and one had one son. And that one son was also like Vena. It was also a real problem. So we find that sometimes there are exceptions, that sometimes in a proper dharmic situation there's a bad child, and sometimes in an irregular situation there's a very good child, that it's an individual circumstance. So those are the two things that kind of jump out here as being unusual. A woman having 10 husbands and this girl born of this relationship with this apsara being so highly qualified that she's becoming the queen of the world and marrying these pure devotees. Okay, now going on to text 17, we're going to look at the difference between the son of the Prachetas, Daksha, and the Prachetas themselves, who apparently have many things in parallel, but one little tiny thing difference makes a huge difference in their lives and their destination. Because the externals of their lives are very similar, but there's something different in their internal mood. And this gives us a key to the real subtle aspect of reincarnation and the laws of the universe. So we'll go over to text 17. Tebyas Tasyam samabhavad
dakshaha
pratejasa
kila
yasya
praja
visargena
loka
apuritas trayaha tebhyas tasyam samabhavad daksha pratejasa kila yasya praja visargena loka apuritas traya
loka apuritas traya
Tebhyaha, from all the prachetas,
tasyam,
in her, samabhavat, was generated, dakshaha, daksha, the expert in begetting children, prachetasaha, the son of the prachetas, kila, indeed, yasya, of whom, praja visargena, by the generation of living entities, lokaha, the worlds, apuritaha, filled, trayaha,
three.
Translation of in the womb of that girl, the prachetas all begot a son named Daksha, who filled the three worlds with living entities. Purport. Daksha was first born during the reign of Swayambhuva Manu, but because of offending Lord Shiva, he was punished by having the head of a goat substituted for his own head. You all know that story? From the fourth canto, the Daksha's sacrifice. Thus, if you don't know that story, there's a little recording from the BBT that was made in the 70s that tells that story. So listen to it. We used to play that for the kids. Thus insulted, he had to give up that body. And in the sixth manvantara, called the Chakshusha manvantara, he was born of the womb of Marisha as Daksha. In this connection, Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur quotes this verse. Chakshushe twantre prapte praksarge kalavidrute yasasarja praja istaha sa daksho daivakoditaha. His previous body had been destroyed, but he, the same Daksha, inspired by the supreme will, created all the desired living entities in the Chakshusha Manvantara, Bhagavatam 4:30-49. Thus Daksha regained his previous opulence and again begot thousands and millions of children to fill the three worlds. So we're going to look now at Daksha, and then we're going to look at the Prachetas. We're going to see what they have in common and what they have different. And we'll see that their external behavior is very, very similar. And there's just a little bit of difference in their internal mentality. And this should give us some key as to our own behavior in Krishna consciousness. Where, I know I make this point quite a bit, but Prabhupada translates the word bhakti as devotional service. And this is also, Jiva Goswami Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur also in talking about Shilanam in the key verse that defines bhakti given by Rupa Goswami, said that Shilanam refers to two kinds of actions, internal and external. And devotional service also implies this. Devotion means one's attitude, and service means one's behavior. So not just devotion and not just service, but both. And we'll find the daksha and the purchetas both engage in service to Vishnu. They both engage in austerities. They both have seemingly, externally, the exact same goal, but they have a different mood. And of course, this is also what Rupa Goswami talks about in Niyamagraha. All right, let's look first at daksha. So daksha's previous verse, which Srila Prabhupada speaks about here in this purport, was as the son of Lord Brahma. And he just manifested. Poof. No birth. Who here has ever seen a birth? Pretty traumatic for the little baby, right? He didn't have to go through that. Just, he didn't have to grow up. Growing up's a pretty intense thing, isn't it? Like even our little monitor there, he can't fully figure out how to use his body yet, how to manipulate it. It takes so long. He can't talk yet. You know, it takes a year, two, three, 4 years before you can even properly speak. Just imagine if today we got in a car accident, or even we fell down the stairs and hit our head on the corner of the stairs and went into a coma and came out of it not knowing who we were and not knowing how to talk. That happens to people. They come out of a coma and they can't remember who their mother and father are. They can't remember their name. They already have a master's degree, but they forgot the alphabet. They can't read. They can't use the bathroom. They don't know how to eat. Pretty scary, huh? I think that's one of our biggest fears, is like going having Alzheimer's or something. But that's what birth is, by the way. That's what death and rebirth is. It's kind of like, you know, getting hit by a truck and going into a coma and waking up and not knowing who you are anymore and having to learn everything all over again and not knowing how to use your little body. So he didn't have to go through that. He didn't have to grow up. Didn't have to go through puberty and go to school and have the other kids tease him because he was shorter and taller or whatever than everybody else. Just. And he was born as the son of the highest brahmana in the universe, Lord Brahma. So just imagine how highly qualified he was. And what was his mission? What was his service for Krishna? What was his service for Krishna? What was he supposed to do? He was supposed to fill up the universe with good population. And that was his service. Right? Many of us have a similar service, either through having children and or through preaching. Isn't that our main service? To fill up our temples with devotees? To fill up the world with devotees and Krishna, with good population. Either to create good population or to change the population into good population. So that was his service. And he did a lot of austerities for the sake of that service. And he was very what about his service? I am a great Prajapati, I'm the son of Lord Brahma, I have this important service. And he wasn't exactly happy that one of his daughters was married to Lord Shiva. He really couldn't understand Lord Shiva. And of course he offended Lord Shiva when at his sacrifice Lord Shiva in trance didn't welcome him, didn't even acknowledge his presence, and he started insulting Lord Shiva out of his pride. So although he was a devotee and he was doing some service, he couldn't respect the other devotees. This is one of the symptoms of the Kanista. The Kanista is worshipping God, but can't respect other living entities. So things didn't go very well for him after that. We know Chaitanya Mahaprabhu compares Vaishnava to a mad elephant in his instructions to Rupa Goswami at Prayag. He talks about the creeper of devotion. You plant the seed, it grows up, and comes to the lotus feet of Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan and bears fruit. He said, but if you let a mad elephant into your garden, he digs up everything. So generally, though, we don't find that if we offend another devotee, we get our head cut off. That doesn't happen usually in the Hare Krishna movement, that some monster comes out of the, you know, comes at us. But that's what happened to Daksha. You know, he tried to do another jagya, and Satya came and said, hey, wait a minute, why are there no oblations to my husband? Better not to have anything to do with you. And she went into mystic trance, meditated on the fire element in her body, and did what's nowadays called spontaneous human combustion. She just went up in flames. And Daksha wasn't even sorry that his own daughter left her body in his presence because of his bad behavior. But Lord Shiva was a little sorry about it, and he pulled out one of his hairs, created a demon. The demon went there and took the axe that was meant to kill the goat for sacrifice and cut off Daksha's head and threw it into the fire. That was the end of poor Daksha's head. And then, well, it was very kind that Lord Shiva said, well, we'll give him a new head. And he took the head of the goat, the jagya, and put it on Daksha's head. So medical miracles were being performed even millions of years ago. You know, I think now we've had 2 face transplants in the world, so there was a head transplant. And of course, what was particularly interesting is that even though it was a goat head, still Daksha had his original consciousness. He wasn't restricted by the fact that he had a little goat brain in his head. Anyway, he offered very nice prayers to Lord Shiva, and he asked for forgiveness. And Lord Shiva forgave him. Then he went through austerities, as Prabhupada describes here, until the 5th Manvantara. So Daksha appeared in the original Manvantara, the Swayambhu Manvantara. Now, Lord Brahma has days. It's explained in the Bhagavad Gita that each of Lord Brahma's days are 1,000 times the 4 yugas. And 1,000 times the 4 yugas is 4,322,000 years. So that's 1,000 times all 4 yugas, a Divya Yuga. And Lord Brahma has, 1,000, that's one of his days. And in one of those, there's, oh, I'm probably getting this wrong. Anyway, I think there's 14 manus. No, okay. Lord Brahma's day is 1,000 times 4,320,000. And in that 1,000 times the 4 yugas, there's, I think, 14 manus. So each manu gets 4,320,000 times 71 years to rule. And you can do the math if you want. I didn't need to play that out. So Daksha did austerities, and he was born in the Swayambhuva millennium. So part of that already passed when he started his austerities. That was with the goat's head on. He was doing his austerities. And then he takes birth again for the Vrachajas in the Chakshusha Manvantara, which is the 5th Manvantara. So he didn't use up that whole Manvantara for austerity. So part of the 1st and part of the 5th and all of the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. So that was at least 4,320,000 times 71 times 3 and times a bit of the other 2. That's a long time to do austerities. So it's kind of like if I offend you and you say, okay, you know, sometimes we do this in ISKCON, somebody offends someone and they say, okay, you can't come to the temple anymore for a while. Or some leader does something wrong and they say, all right, you have to go to Mayapur, Vrindavan, and just sit in here and chant for a while, right? But I don't think anyone has been given 4,320,000 times 71 times 4 years to do austerities if they've done something wrong. Anyway, that's how long he did austerities. And then because of all those austerities, Lord Shiva was very pleased with him. And it's explained in the 4th canto that Lord Shiva then restored all of his material opulence. And he was able to then again take birth in a situation where, as it's explained here, again he got his same service back. That he's able to create so many thousands of good living in these good children. All of us want to have good children, right? None of us want to have bad children. We all want children who are attractive, intelligent, competent, and very nice devotees of Krishna. So he was able to have millions of children. Pretty nice. Huh? So he got that opulence back. However, we find that this time he takes birth not from a brahmana, but from kshatriya. The Prachetas are kshatriyas. And he has to have a mother this time. He has to have a mommy who's Marisha. And he has to actually go in the womb and come out and be born and grow up and all that kind of stuff. So Prabhupada explains that taking birth from kshatriyas and having to be in a woman's womb and grow up was the result of his having offended Lord Shiva. Now you might say, well, wait a minute. He asked forgiveness from Lord Shiva, didn't he? And Lord Shiva forgave him, and he did 4,320,000 times 71 times 4 years of austerities. Shouldn't that be enough? Why did he still have to suffer? Okay, he got his opulences back, but still he had a lower position. Well, what are we going to notice as this chapter goes on? What is Daksha going to do again in this life? He's going to offend somebody. Who's he going to offend this time?
Narada.
Okay. Now, what we're about to read in the Hamsa Guhya prayers, the Hamsa Guhya prayers are offered by Daksha to Lord Vishnu. So before Daksha starts his work of generating good population in this birth, he prays to Lord Vishnu. And he offers beautiful prayers in the Bhagavatam. And they're so nice that Lord Vishnu comes personally. And Lord Vishnu says, I will bless you with the fulfillment of your desire. And it's explained that when Daksha saw Lord Vishnu, he was feeling Baba. The word is there, Bhagavatam, Baba. And Lord Vishnu said, this is the girl you should marry. This is the children you should have. And so on. Okay? That's Daksha. Now let's go to the Prachetas. The Prachetas are the sons of Prachinabharisha, who's in the family of Dhruva Maharaj, and they also were given a very similar instruction. They were told, we want you to, they weren't just supposed to generate offspring, they were Kshatriyas, they were supposed to rule the world. Their father says, we want you to rule the world, and we also want you to have good children. And in order to become qualified for that, you should perform austerities. So they also performed austerities, I think it was for 10,000 years. And instead of going to the Himalayas so they wouldn't be bothered, they went under the ocean. Generally, if you want to do austerity, you go someplace where people won't bother you. Yeah. Have you ever tried to chant 64 rounds in the middle of a festival? It's hard, isn't it? Sometimes it's hard to chant 16 rounds in the middle of a festival. You know, Janmashtami. Oh, Prabhu, can you do this? Can you do this? Can you do this? Can you do this? And how many devotees at 11 o'clock at night are still finishing 16 rounds? Would you speak of chanting 64 or 192? So, you know, if you want to do some austerities, you go away from the general population so nobody will bother you. So they would go to the Himalayas, they'd go in a cave, and the Prachetas went under the water, which meant that they could control their breathing, obviously. And there they did austerities for same purpose as Daksha, and they also saw Lord Vishnu. And Lord Vishnu also said to them, yes, you will have the fulfillment of all of your desires, and also said to them, this is the woman you should marry, who now they've married in this story, and you will have very good children. Now, there was a benediction Lord Vishnu gave the Prachetas that he didn't give to Daksha. And that was, he said, you will always be engaged in my devotional service, and at the end you will come back to me. Didn't say that to Daksha. And we find that the Prachetas had a very gentle mentality. Now, obviously, they also had a Kshatriya mentality, but they were described as being very mild and gentle, which is why Lord Shiva gave them his benedictions. And later, at the end of their life, when they took up the Vanaprastha ashram, they became, instead of the offenders of Narada Muni, they became the disciples of Narada Muni. We see another parallel here. We see two personalities who are present in the lives of both Daksha and the Prachetas. Who are those two personalities? Lord Shiva and Narada Muni. Lord Shiva is the Diksha Guru of the Prachetas. He gives them their mantra to chant. And Narada Muni is their Shiksha Guru. So we find the Prachetas are the disciples of Lord Shiva and Narada, and Daksha is the offender of Shiva and Narada. Right? But they both get to see Lord Vishnu, and they both do austerities, and they both want to populate the universe with good children, and they do both populate the universe with good children. Although the Prachetas is described here, just have this one son. I don't know if they had any more. It's not described. Whereas Daksha had directly so many thousands and thousands of sons. So this, of course, reminds us where Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that what's night for one person is day for another. And Prabhupada in that purport says two people are doing the same thing, but they're getting different results. We're going out and selling books. Are other people selling books in the world? Of course. So many people are selling so many books. So many of the things that we're doing, we're cooking, so many people are cooking. Not too many people sit around making keywords and garlands, that's a little unusual. But of course, if you go to Hawaii, people are making garlands. Right? You go to Hawaii, there's so many shops where you can buy garlands. And if, at least if you stay in one of the fancy hotels, when you get off the airplane, somebody will come and garland you. So other people involved in making bodies. The external behaviors of Dakshin and Prachetas were very, very similar. So what was different? Their mentality was completely different. I wouldn't say completely. It wasn't completely different. Because Dakshin also wanted to serve Lord Vishnu. It wasn't that he didn't want to serve Lord Vishnu. We couldn't say that. He wanted to serve Lord Vishnu. He wanted to benefit the universe. He certainly isn't a demon. He wasn't opposed to Lord Vishnu. So what was different in their mentality? Anybody? Dakshin was definitely proud. He thought he was better than Lord Shiva. And he thought he was better than Nara. He thought he knew better how to have a good population and how to raise his children than Nara did. What else was different? I mean, does this matter to us? What kind of result do we want to have? The Prachetas get to go back to Godhead and spend a life in devotional service, and Daksha keeps taking lower and lower births. What else was different besides pride?
The Prachetas correction.
Okay, the Prachetas could take correction, yeah. Like when they were burning down the trees. Daksha had a pretty hard time taking correction. Now, he did say he was sorry to Lord Shiva. Any idea why, even though he told Lord Shiva he was sorry and Shiva forgave him and he did all the austerities, he still had to suffer? Shouldn't that have finished it off? No, we can see. How was the evidence that his mentality didn't change?
He did the same thing.
So, of course, this is very typical. With children, it's very obvious. You know, one child hits the other child on the head with a toy, and you say, "Say you're sorry," and they go, "Sorry." They usually won't even look at the kid that they hit over the head. Sorry, we just look at the floor. Or they look at you and say, "You're not supposed to apologize to me, you're supposed to apologize to the person you hurt." So why is the child saying you're sorry? Because you told them to, and because? They wonder what they're obeying their parents. Why? Yeah, that's right. They want to go on with what they were doing. And you're probably telling the kid, until you say you're sorry, you're going to stand in the corner. Or until you say you're sorry, you know, you're not going to come to dinner or whatever, right? So they want to finish their dinner or they want to go on playing, so they say they're sorry. So that's what Daksha did. He wanted him, what did he want? His opulences, his power. It's kind of embarrassing to have a goat head, isn't it? Isn't that a little embarrassing? Imagine if you had to walk in the temple tomorrow with a goat head. How'd you get that?
I offended a devotee.
Just imagine if every time we committed Vaishnava Aparad, we got to, you know, our head started looking like a goat. You know, you might go say you're sorry just so you could look normal again. Even if you didn't feel that way, we'd have a lot more apologizing going on between devotees. But what is real sorry? What does it really mean to be sorry? You're not going to do it again? What are you feeling, though? If you're really sorry, what do you feel? Somewhat? Or you feel some repentance? What sort of, what, What's pushing you to be repentant? Are you repentant that you got caught and punished? What are you repentant about? Some self-respect. Okay, you realize you made a mistake, but are you thinking of the mistake in terms of, I made a mistake and I got caught and I'm suffering and I want to be happy, so I'm not going to do that again?
Not doing what you're supposed to do.
Okay, then I, again, but doing what I'm supposed to be doing, am I thinking about me? Am I thinking about, you know, my happiness? I want to go on with my opulence. I want to go on with my life. I want peace of mind. That's all me. I don't want to hurt others' feelings. Okay, why? Okay, because you know what that's like. And Krishna talks about that in the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. He says that the yogi understands other people's happiness and distress in comparison to his own. I was just listening this morning while I was doing my puja. Prabhupada was talking. It's a section where Uddhava is reading Krishna's letter to the gopis. And he's saying how that one who loves Krishna also becomes a lover of all living entities. Right? Brahma Bhuta Prasanatmana Sotachina Kantati Sama Sarveshu Bhuteshu. So one sees all living entities equally. Of course, Krishna also describes himself like this, Suridam Sarvabhutanam, that he's the friend of all living entities. Sarvayam Shikantaya, Murtaya Sambhavantaya, Tasana Brahma Mahayami, Aham Bija Pitapitaha. I'm the father of everyone. So real sari involves something called love. It involves something called caring. That I care about another living entity and I feel bad that that living entity has suffered some hurt on my account. It's something called empathy. Now that's pretty rare among conditioned souls because we're very much self-absorbed. So Daksha is very self-absorbed. He's not really very concerned. Not only is he unconcerned about how Lord Shiva might have felt pained, but he's even unconcerned with how his own daughter felt pained, to the point that she gave up her body. It didn't concern him. He was, as Prabhupada says in that purport, in the 4th canto, very hard-hearted. So therefore, even though he sees the Lord and experiences ecstasy upon seeing the Lord, and even though he's engaged in service, and he does all these austerities. And he's got, I mean, how can you have a better family than that? You know, first you have Lord Brahma as your father, then you have the Prachetas as your father. Fathers. Still, his heart doesn't change. He's doing things externally, but his motives are selfish. And he's not interested in changing his motives. He wants to serve Lord Vishnu to facilitate getting his own opulence. He wants to serve Lord Shiva to get his own opulence. His interest is his own opulence and his own power. That's his interest. His interest is not the Lord Vishnu's business. He's using Lord Vishnu to facilitate his own purposes. Which is, of course, the mentality of all conditioned souls. Whereas the Prachetas, who are apparently doing externally very much the same thing, their purpose is the opposite. They want to engage their desires to please Vishnu. They want to engage their abilities to please Vishnu rather than engaging Vishnu to fulfill their desires. And therefore their mood is very gentle and very mild, although they're warriors. They're not like worthy people. But they have real compassion and love for all living entities, which has then brought the mercy of the devotees upon them and given them not only all material opulences, but also all transcendental knowledge. So we, in this Hare Krishna movement, the purpose of our external activities, the purpose of our chanting 16 rounds and 3 Gayatris and offering arti, confessing the deities and cooking and making ghee wicks and making garlands and putting on a dhoti and putting on a sari and putting on tilak and all these things that we, all of our behaviors, the purpose of all those is to develop devotion and to express devotion. And as far as our material desires, we depend on Krishna for the fulfillment of our material desires as he wants. We submit our material desires to him. My dear Lord, these are my material desires. It's up to you. You do with them as you like. If you want to fulfill them, fine. You don't want to fulfill them, fine. However you want to fulfill them, that's your business. I put those at your feet and offer them to you in service if they can be of any use. But I'm not serving you for the purpose of getting my material desires fulfilled. I'm serving you for the purpose of yoga. I'm serving you for the purpose of relationship. And I want to deal with all living entities just like you do as your children. And because I love you, I love all living entities. Now, we shouldn't think here that Krishna is partial. You might say, you know, Daksha's doing something, the Prachetas are doing basically the same thing. Why are they getting different results? Well, Krishna's not partial. It's not that he loves the Prachetas more than he loves Daksha. He loves them equally. Krishna reciprocates, and Krishna is, he very much will give us what we want. He very much will give us what we want. So, frankly, Daksha's getting what he wants. He wants to stay in the material world and be a powerful, opulent person. And he's getting it. And the Prachetas are getting what they want. And they want to have a loving relationship with Krishna and do some service for him in this world and in the spiritual world, and they're getting it. So, that is... everything we do, we should think of what is the purpose of what I'm doing. Is what I'm doing developing my love for Krishna? And is what I'm doing an expression of love for Krishna? So. Any questions, comments? Yes.
Come first. Respect or love?
Respect or love?
Which is the most important?
I think respect comes first.
Very much
so. I think respect comes first. Just from the concept that before entering into Raghunuga Bhakti, you have to first perform Vaidhi Bhakti. In other words, first you have to perform service according to rules and regulations with respect, with reverence. Prabhupada uses the word awe and reverence. Before you can develop love, it's impossible to love someone you don't respect. And respect is something, you know, it's kind of hard to train love. Okay, we're going to have a class on how to love, but you can train respect.
You can offer respect every morning without congratulating. Offer my respect to a relationship. But if you've got no self respect, where is the value of offering?
Well, that's an interesting point. If we have no self-respect, can we respect others? I don't really have the time. This is a very confusing subject for devotees in the Hare Krishna movement, this concept of self-respect. Because we say this first, Trinada Pisa Michina, you know, I'm supposed to offer all respect to others without expecting any respect in return. And so it sounds like I can respect all living entities without having any respect for myself. So sometimes people think that if they denigrate themselves, they'll be able to respect others. But at the same time, Krishna says that we should understand the happiness of distress of others in relationship to our own self. And of course, Prabhupada likes to quote Chanakya Pandit, who says that a learned person does three things, speaking from the point of view of a man. That a man sees all women except his wife as mothers, that he sees property that's not his as untouchable, like trash in the street that you don't touch, and he treats all other people the way he wants to be treated. And of course, this treating all others the way you want to be treated, that particular rule is evident, I think, in 100% of the societies on the planet, although I'll stand ready to be corrected. Maybe there's some society that's not like that. As far as I know, even atheists say that. Treat others, not treat others the way you are treated, treat others the way you would like to be treated. Now, if you have no self-respect, that makes no sense. That injunction just is meaningless. So how do we then? And also, we just see, practically speaking, that people who have no self-respect have a really hard time respecting others. They tend to be very angry people. So how do we put together those two things, that there has to be some self-respect, and at the same time, this idea of humility, that you don't expect any respect? So that's a very lengthy discussion. Maybe we can have like a 2-hour seminar on that, or 2-hour a day for a week seminar on that. It's a very deep subject. And I was working with a group of devotees in London where we were trying to formulate what would be our values in the school that we were starting. And we really got stuck on this idea of self-respect, or what's called in modern circles self-esteem. Did we want the kids to have self-esteem? And if so, what did we mean by that? And was that a Vaishnava principle or not? And how would we explain it? And, you know, we spent a lot of time on that. And I don't know if we came to some firm conclusion. So it's a deep subject, not something I have time to go into now. But okay, thank you for bringing that up. Certainly, I was just also reading in Prayers of the Personified Vedas, where Prabhupada says that for the devotee, maintenance of his body is devotional service, because he's using his body in Krishna service. So I would say maintenance of your mind is devotional service too. That's a deep topic. Anything else? Okay, thank you very much. I'll always appreciate that.